This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Well, we're heading into the final hours of campaigning for the local, Scottish, mayoral and Hartlepool by-elections. James, how are things looking?
So we've had an absolute flurry of polls today. And they all tell interesting stories. So the Scottish polling, most polls seem to have the SNP on course for a majority on their own or in combination with the Greens. I think it is quite clear that the next Scottish Parliament is going to have a pro independence majority, and that I think will lead in time to a request for a Section 30 order. I think it is also though quite interesting that polls which show the SNP on course for a majority also tend to show the no side ahead, which does suggest that we shouldn't read across from, oh, the SNP or pro-independence parties have won a majority, therefore it's inevitable that the independent side would win in any second referendum. Welsh poll out today suggests Labour will be the largest party, but might be short of a majority. Unsurprisingly, the London polls all point to Sadiq Khan winning relatively comfortably. And I don't think we have had any new polls in the West Midlands or Teesside or Hartlepool. But I think one of the challenges for Labour, and this is you might say this is a ridiculous thing to say, but I think it is true, is because the Hartlepool result is counting overnight, that will be the kind of result that people wake up to 6 a.m., 7 a.m. in the morning. And that will, I think, will then frame the coverage of what is happening in England for the rest of the day. And I think that could be, if that Servation poll showing the Tories 70 points ahead, if that is anywhere near right, and in fact the Guardian ran a story that only 40% of Labour's 2019 voters holding up suggests that that if not right in the sheer margin of a lead, is right that about the likelihood of the result. I mean, the danger is that Labour will be kind of on the defensive in their media rounds from the beginning of the day. And even if they get a good result in London, good results in Wales, that will be drowned out by the news out of Hartlepool.
Fraser, how serious would a Labour loss in Hartlepool be? The party has been trying to spin some of the feedback from the doorstep, saying that voters seem less angry than they did in the 2015, 2017 and 2019 elections. But that doesn't make a huge amount of sense if those voters, while still less angry, turn against the party for the first time since the seat's creation. So is Keir Starmer in real trouble if he does lose this seat?
It's certainly deeply embarrassing for him. He said only a few days ago that he does think these elections will be a reflection of his personal leadership. And of course, that's true. I mean, you know, Isabel, you're telling us how you're up with Anas Sarwar in Scotland a few days ago. Now, he's been party leader for only a few weeks before this campaign. So if it goes badly for him, you could say, well, this isn't really a reflection of me. Keir Starmer does not have the same get-out clause, unfortunately. Now, you can see the excuses he might be making. He's saying, yes, Brexit is over, but by the way, look at the Brexit Party vote. The Brexit Party is no more, so all of us guys will have gone to the Tories, so maybe it's not so bad for Labour. But really, I think the story might turn until not so much to the Tory triumph, but to what on earth is happening with the Labour Party. Now, Polly Toynbee in The Guardian had an interesting piece the other day telling voters that they had, in her words, no excuse this time not to vote for Labour now that the Corbyn's gone and that they've not got a centrist Labour Party there. What more could they want? It's a very good question, and I think it's a question to which Labour still doesn't have the answer. And by the way, I don't have the answer either. What has happened in the North is still a question that baffles lots of political parties, including, by the way, the Tories, who are the beneficiaries of all this. If you look at the YouGov poll, they show a Tory poll lead amongst the working class of something like 17 or 18 points, like twice the lead it is amongst ABC1 voters. So what we're seeing is the Tories becoming, by some margin, the choice of the British working class. Now, then you can get to, already you're hearing some of the excuses, well, look at Hartlepool, they're all old, they're poor, etc., they're yesterday's demographic. But the funny thing is about modern politics is that so many elections now are decided by such voters, the voters who feel that they are no longer part of the conversation. If the polls are true, and by the way, I should say the amount of times that polls haven't been right in the last few years, we shouldn't assume that they are going to be right. But if they are right, then I think not only will stories of Dominic Cummings's revelations fade away quite quickly, but we will be asking, what is it? Why is it that these northern constituencies, with Corbyn gone, are almost, if anything, less inclined to turn to Labour now than they were when Corbyn was there?
James, would it be as big a deal for the Conservatives if, having had a lot of discussion over the past few weeks about the likelihood that they could win this seat, they actually end up failing to win it? Is that going to be a problem for them, or are they able to brush it off quite easily still?
Yeah, it's one of those logical arguments. But if the Tories fall short by 10 votes in Hartlepool, say, it would still indicate that Labour in dire trouble. But I bet you if Labour win that seat by 10 votes, Keir Starmer will be up there on Friday morning raising the arm of the victorious Labour candidate and spinning it as a great triumph and saying, well, we were losing, but then sleaze started to cut through and voters started to realise the true nature of the Tories. Imagine Keir Starmer saying, the mask slipped and the voters of Hartlepool realised, and we'd have done a lot better if so many people hadn't voted by post. And all, you can hear all that already. So I think it would be a problem for the Tories now, given how high expectations are if they didn't in Hartlepool. And you see their desperate attempts at expectation management, slightly undercut by the fact that Boris Johnson has visited the seat three times, something that prime ministers tend not to do unless they think they are pretty likely to take it.
Hasn't been in Scotland once.
I think Scotland is a fascinating point. I think the Scotland thing is that obviously Boris Johnson's approval ratings, which are very high in Hartlepool, are not high in Scotland, put it mildly. I think there is another problem with Boris Johnson visiting Scotland, which is that he undercuts the entire argument of the Scottish Conservative campaign, which is any interviewer worth their salt would say to Boris Johnson, will you allow a second independence referendum? Boris Johnson would say, no, now is not the time. You should be concentrating on recovering from coronavirus. Given that basically the only policy that the Scottish Tories have majored on in this campaign is the idea that you have to vote for them to stop the SNP from getting a majority and holding a second independence referendum, that would pull the rug out from under the Scottish Tories. So I suspect if Boris Johnson was popular in Scotland, he would be visiting anyway. Obviously, the fact he's not makes this a relatively easy calculation, but I think that extent to which the Tory party have not yet worked out how to coordinate their Scottish messaging with the government's messaging on this is one of the things that makes it more awkward for any cabinet ministers to head to Scotland.
Fraser, it's not just about the absence of Boris Johnson on the Scottish campaign trail. One of the striking things I've noticed about the leaflets that have been popping through my doormat in West Lothian, and also all the operational notes that we get from the Scottish Conservatives, is that Ruth Davidson features far more prominently in many of these opportunities and leaflets than Douglas Ross, who is the actual leader. What's going on there?
Implosion, I think that's what's happening there. They have gotten Douglas Ross, a leader who they don't seem to think is plausible as a First Minister candidate. That's why they're not selling him as one. Ruth Davidson is going to the House of Lords after this Holyrood election. She isn't even standing as a candidate. Yet there's no doubt, I've seen her in the campaign messages, it just reminds you of just how good the Scottish Tories have been, but also how relatively thin the Ruth Davidson project was. It wasn't able to regenerate. Douglas Ross is not the great successor which she had billed him as being. And one of the people that helped Douglas Ross in his early days was a former colleague of mine called Eddie Barnes. He used to work for Ruth Davidson as her spin doctor. And as you have revealed in Coffee House, Isabel, Eddie Barnes is now helping Anas Sarwar. So I think that's quite interesting, because there'll be many unionists who will be looking at the Scottish Tories and thinking, no, you really are not the most convincing force to stop the SNP. And they'll be looking at Anas Sarwar and thinking, right now, if you're a unionist, you care about the union way more than you cared about who the next First Minister is. So you would lend your vote into whatever force you thought was most likely to curtail Nicola Sturgeon. The Tories don't really have a message for that. And that is why they've ended up in this particular mess. I'm not quite sure if they need to find a new leader, but it seems that the momentum is behind Anas Sarwar, and that the Scottish Tory miracle, which Ruth Davidson spun out of absolutely nowhere, might not last her departure.
James.
I think the Scottish Tories have their 20% of the electorate that, you know, who are hardline unionists. So I think we'll carry on voting for them, which is a better position than the Scottish Tories found themselves in, you know, if you go back 10 years or so. But I think the interesting thing about Anas Sarwar is, although Scottish Labour's ratings have not gone up dramatically in this campaign, and the polls, most polls seem to suggest the Tories will hold on to second place in their role as the official opposition, Anas Sarwar's personal ratings have increased. I think that could be hugely significant. I thought it was fascinated by your piece, your interview with him in the magazine this week as well. I mean, that could be hugely significant for a second independence referendum campaign, because he has not majored on the constitution in this campaign in the way the Tories have. He is more going for social democratic voters who are, you know, might have been drawn to the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon, not necessarily as a party of independence, but as a party of the left. And I think this actually is, for the first time, I thought one of the problems for any unionist effort in a second independence referendum was you would be relying on Gordon Brown as the kind of sole figure to kind of reach that. And obviously, he retired from frontline politics quite some time ago. I think it gives them some potential reach in that campaign into those middle ground voters, because, you know, it's not going to simply be enough to turn out everyone in Scotland who is already committed to the union, which is essentially the Scottish Tory strategy, and the people who there politicians have reached to.
But the only sort of optimistic note for unionists in this campaign is the polls that show independents losing support. So there was a poll recently showing that support is now back down to where it was in the 2014 referendum. That has not sapped the SNP support. So right now, support for Nicola Sturgeon is larger than support for independence. Now, that, of course, that might think that if there were to be a referendum, and in my opinion, there ought to be one if the Scottish Parliament votes for one, then it should be winnable for unionists. But right now, it's hard to see what stops a pro-independence majority in tomorrow's election.
Thank you, Fraser, and thank you, James.